From KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. The brilliant Vincent Bugliosi died on June 6th. He was 80. Mr. Bugliosi successfully prosecuted Charles Manson and several of his followers in 1969. He was also a brilliant writer, and he's been a guest on From the Bookshelf several times. This week, we listen back to our 2007 conversation. Vincent Bugliosi had just published what he called his magnum opus, Reclaiming History, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. This 1,600-page book, which won several awards, makes the argument that President Kennedy was indeed killed by Lee Harvey Oswald rather than conspirators.
You know, when your book arrived on my door, I thought someone had sent me 7 books, but... It turned out it was just yours.
Actually, it's the equivalent of about 13 volumes of 400-page books, if you include the CD-ROM.
That's right, there's a CD-ROM. The book is hard to read in bed, because if you rest it on your chest, you cannot breathe with that book on you.
I know. Well, my editor had this nightmare of some woman reading, some elderly woman or older woman or kind of slightly built woman, reading the book in bed at night. She falls asleep with the book on top of her, and she doesn't wake up in the morning. It just crushes her. No, it's a humongous book. But, you know, I did not write this book for the money. I certainly hoped it would make money. Don't get me wrong, I did. But that's not why I wrote the book. With the increasing superficiality in our society, Gary, and the, I don't know what you call it, need for or the desire for instant gratification, and fewer people are reading books. If you want to make money, you do not put out a book of over 1,600 pages. It actually weighs about 7.5 pounds. Cost over $50, although for some reason on Amazon.com it's much more inexpensive. But you don't put out a book like that if you want to make money. The book has over 10,000 citations in it. That's all in the CD-ROM, and it's equivalent at 1.5 million words of 13 volumes of 400-page books. I can tell you what my state of mind was. It'll sound immodest, but I'm telling you the truth. When I was writing the book, my goal, my objective, my state of mind is I wanted to write a book for the ages. And interestingly enough, the LA Times in the review of the book said, finally someone has put all the pieces together. Reclaiming History is a book for the ages. The very famous American novelist Scott Turow gave a review saying, centuries from now, people are going to be reading Reclaiming History. The Philadelphia Inquirer said 100 years from now, when historians want to know what happened on the Kennedy case, they'll read Reclaiming History. And I think that's the reason why Tom Hanks and his people are doing a 10-hour miniseries for HBO on the book. It sounds boastful, and I hate to boast about a book, but the only problem, Gary, is that if I don't, then the alternative is almost worse, because someone could say, well, this is just another one of the close to 1,000 books on the assassination, and it's not. In a strange sort of way, Gary, the belief that President Kennedy was killed by dark, powerful forces because he was taking the country in a direction that they did not like, in a strange way, that almost gives more meaning to his life, certainly more meaning than the belief that a lone nut with a deranged mind killed him. In fact, Jackie herself, the president's wife, said that she said, we didn't even have the satisfaction of the president being killed for some cause like civil rights. He had to be killed, she said, by some silly little communist, and she says it robs a president's death of meaning. So people found it intellectually incongruous that someone they perceived to be a king, Kennedy, he was captivating a world audience with his wit, his charm, his intelligence, could be struck down in a moment by someone they perceived to be a peasant, as it were. And they said, you know, something more has got to be involved here. They just could not believe that Kennedy's on top of the world, smiling to admiring crowds, and his good-looking wife, his beautiful wife sitting next to him, he's on top of the world, and a second later it's all over with. Of course, bullets are very democratic, and they kill or injure whomever they hit, and you don't have to be important to pull that trigger, but there's just this instinctive notion that something more had to be involved.
In the first part of Reclaiming History, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, it's an exhaustive minute-by-minute account of the 4 days in November 1963.
Right.
And now you often quote Oswald directly. How were you able to do this?
Well, you know, many people have read the first 4 days, and they said it reads like a novel with all the conversations and everything like that. The reason I was able to do that, Gary, is because this case, the historical record, is so rich. It's so rich that you literally can write it in a novelistic sense, although a good part of the book is not written that way. But the first 4 days and the Oswald biography are written that way because so many people gave statements or testified under oath, and you take those statements verbatim, and you can put them into the book, and it reads like you're writing a novel. But I did not make these conversations up. These were statements made under oath or in an affidavit by a great number of people about this case. Normally, if you write in a narrative form about a crime, you're going to have to invent some conversations. But this case, as I say, is so rich that I was able to pluck these conversations out of the historical record.
But you even say that Oswald said something sullenly, or he said it arrogantly, or you even quote Oswald's wife, Marina Oswald's thoughts in one scene. How could you do this?
Where do I quote her thoughts? If I quoted her thoughts, it's probably because she said at one point that I thought. You follow?
Uh-huh.
I don't know. You know, I may have done what you're suggesting, but by and large, I can tell you that if I said that she had the thought, that would have come from her testimony that she had this thought. You follow? It wasn't a case of my opening up the top of her mind and peeking in and saying, uh-huh, that's what you were thinking. I don't think I did that. But, no, the book is pretty factual. It's a pretty factual book. As I say, it may be the most heavily sourced nonfiction book ever to be written. Now, the reason I say that, and I don't know this to be a fact, but it had been said, I had heard, that the Warren Report was the most heavily sourced book ever. And that book, the Warren Report, had 6,500 citations. This book has over 10,000 citations in small font or print. It's 170 pages of citations. And so just about everything I have there, I have some pretty good source for it.
Now, what do you think Oswald's motive for killing President Kennedy was?
You know, I that's your first real question, and it's tough. You've asked me a tough one, Gary. You've done your homework. I've often told people, you know, I said, this is a book that belongs in any serious home library because it has the answers to every question that anyone could possibly ask about this case, plus the answers to many questions that the average person would not even dream of asking. It's a reference book, in addition to other things. But that question there that you asked, I don't have the answer to. Even if Oswald were alive, Gary, and wanted to convey to us what was on his mind, he may not have been able to tell us the all of the dynamics swirling around in that fevered brain of his that eventuated itself into this monstrous act of murder. But there are certain things that we do know, and I can just touch on a few of them, but there's many more in the book. One is that Oswald had delusions of grandeur. He viewed himself in a historical light. In fact, his diary was called the Historical Diary. A squad mate of his in the Marines said that Oswald wanted to do something that 10,000 years from now people would be talking about. His wife, Marina, said that Oswald compared himself to the great figures of history whom he read about in biographies. So here's someone who wasn't interested in just changing or creating a ripple. He wanted to change the tide of history. Getting a little bit more specific, he revered Fidel Castro, no question about that. You're aware that in late September, early October of 1963, he tried to get down to Cuba through the Mexican consulate in Cuba, and in Mexico City, and he was turned down, and he became very emotional, almost started to cry. So he was a strong, fervent supporter of the Cuban Revolution, and we know that Kennedy approved and supported the Bay of Pigs invasion to overthrow Castro, and I agree with the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee that one of his motives, because you're asking why he did it, which is a good question, is that he probably felt that in killing Kennedy, an enemy of Castro, he was furthering the Cuban cause. I came across something else, Gary, that I gave to the jury in London. Just very briefly, you know that I, quote, prosecuted Oswald in 1986. That's how I got involved in this case. It wasn't a real prosecution, of course, but...
A TV drama.
Yeah, but, Time Magazine called it the closest to a real trial that the accused assassin would likely ever have. This was in London. It was 21 hours. Jerry Spence defended Oswald, and... We worked on it for about 5 months. We had the real witnesses, a real judge, real jury, no script, no actors. And while I was preparing for that trial and reading his historical diary, there was something that leapt off the page to me that may not have had as much significance to the average person, and it goes back to, you were mentioning my prosecution of Charles Manson. Manson did not know the identity of the people he was having his minions kill. He knew that they were white. He knew that they were representatives of the establishment, but he did not know their precise identity. So, in a sense, it was a representative type of killing. He did not know exactly who they were. And I'm reading Oswald's biography, and not his biography, his diary. And there was this entry. He said, I've lived under capitalism and communism, and he said, I quote, these are his exact words, I think, I despise the representatives of both systems. And the word representatives leapt off the page to me, and the reason why that was important to me is because Oswald, by the evidence, the circumstantial evidence, did not hate President Kennedy. He hated the United States of America. There's no question about that. But he did not hate Kennedy. There are certain things about Kennedy he did not like. He certainly did not like the Bay of Pigs invasion, but he liked his position on civil rights, and he had no passion against Kennedy per se. And, of course, that was an argument that Jerry Spence made in London. Why would he kill Kennedy when he did not hate Kennedy? But the thing is, he did hate the United States of America, and then I see this entry in his diary that he despised the representatives of both systems. So I argued to the jury, not knowing, I didn't know what his exact motive was. Like I said, maybe he wouldn't even know it. But I said that Kennedy, I was just putting this on their plate for their consideration, Kennedy may have represented to Oswald, he may have been the quintessential representative of a society for which he held a grinding contempt. And when he was firing at Kennedy, he may have been firing at the United States of America. But there are many other things involved in trying to answer your very tough question. I do not have the answer to that question. No one can, because Oswald is dead. But I hope I've illuminated a little bit as to why he may have done what he did.
We're speaking with Vincent Bugliosi, who is the author of a new book called Reclaiming History, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's a little volume that he whipped off in the last 25 years.
I love your sense of humor. Yeah, I worked on it for over 20 years, and it's, the Kennedy case is the most important murder case in American history, and the book is my, every author who's written more than a couple books, they have their magnum opus. Reclaiming History is my magnum opus, the book of my career. I can't do any better than this book. I put everything into it that I learned as a prosecutor of criminal cases and a writer of true crime. So it's the book of my career.
Let's go over just a few points from the Warren Commission that are controversial.
Okay.
Let's start with the single bullet theory.
Okay.
Now, Josiah Thompson, a respected, even by you apparently, conspiracy theorist, he says that 3 or 4 seconds would have been required between the shots for accuracy in shooting with Oswald's rifle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you see, that's not quite accurate. There have been quite a few people who have said similar things, that no one has been able to duplicate what Oswald did. That's not quite true. There was a specialist, Miller, for the U.S. Army at the time, the Warren Commission, who duplicated what Oswald did. My firearms guy from Wisconsin, who was my firearms specialist, and he was on the firearms panel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, he duplicated, and not only duplicated, but beat what Oswald did in terms of accuracy and timing. CBS, back in the mid-60s, found someone who actually beat what Oswald did. So it's something that is not quite accurate when people say no one has ever duplicated what Oswald did. You could get off 2 rounds within a short period of time. If Oswald were using iron sights, he could have gotten now off two rounds in 1.67 seconds. Now, they may not have been that accurate, but you could fire two shots in 1.67 seconds. The other point that people have to realize is that the clock, Gary, really only starts running at the time of the first shot, because up to that point, Oswald had all the time he needed to prepare for it. I mean, the cartridge is already in the chamber, so all he has to do is pull the trigger, and then the clock starts running, and there would be another 8 seconds after that. The first shot was fired somewhere around 160 in the Zapruder film, frame 160. The headshot, we know when that was fired, because we can see the explosion to the head at frame 313. That's 8.4 seconds. So after he gets the first shot off, he literally has got he got 8.4 seconds to fire the remaining two shots. It gets a little sophisticated, but I go into all of that in a considerable amount of detail in the book. And the shots were not that difficult. They were not that difficult. The first shot that hit the president, somewhere around 60 yards away, that's close. The second shot, somewhere around 88 yards away. You know, when you're firing out on the range, Gary, for the record, you fire at 100 yards, 200 yards, 300 yards, and 500 yards. So these two shots that hit the president were below 100 yards. The presidential limousine was traveling very slowly, around 10 and a half miles, around 11 miles per hour. If you've ever gone up to that window up there and imagine holding a rifle, the barrel is almost on a straight line with Elm Street. Conveniently, there's even a declination to Elm Street of 3.9 degrees, which eliminates the necessity of elevating the muzzle as the weapon gets farther away from the limousine. And my firearms guy in London told the jury that for all intents and purposes, the president was a stationary target. And yet, if you listen to the conspiracy theorists, they act like it was almost an impossible shot, but it wasn't.
Well, speaking of the Zapruder film, the film that Abraham Zapruder shot of the president's assassination, let's talk about frame, I think it's frame 225. As the car is emerging from behind the Stemmons Freeway sign, you can see that President Kennedy has been hit. He's clutching his throat.
Right.
And yet Governor Connally, who was supposedly hit by the same bullet, is still composed.
No, actually, the House Select Committee felt that he was not composed. As early as frame 222, they felt his upper torso had stiffened. And, of course, he didn't raise his arms to his throat like Kennedy did. But they had quite a few photographic experts from around the country. I think it was 21. And they came to the conclusion that when Connally first emerged from the Stemmons Freeway sign, you could first see him a good part of his body at frame 222, and then Kennedy, like you say, at 225, he already had stiffened up. But the point you were making is that if he was not responding at 222, and Kennedy was at 225, then they must have been struck by two separate bullets.
Yes.
And I agree with you if that were the case, but the consensus of the House Select Committee and the Warren Commission is that they were struck by the same bullet. You know what the conspiracy theorists do? You've heard of the magic bullet, of course.
Right. They say that the bullet moved in space.
Right.
Turned right and then turned left.
Right. Now what they do to prove that, Gary, or try to prove it, and I show this in Reclaiming History with the sketch that they use. They place Governor Connally directly in front of President Kennedy in the presidential limousine, and then they say a bullet coming from the right rear, where Oswald supposedly was at the Book Depository Building, passing through soft tissue right to left. To hit Connally, they say, would have to make a right turn in midair and then make a left turn to go on to hit Connally. Well, of course, if you start out with an erroneous premise, everything that follows makes a heck of a lot of sense. The only problem is that it's wrong, and Connally was not seated directly in front of Kennedy. There's absolutely no question about it, and I show photos in the book, or I show one photo, and then, of course, if you look at the Zapruder film itself, you can see very, very clearly Connally was seated to Kennedy's left front. He was in a jump seat a half a foot in from the door. Now, in London, Spence had coroner, Cyril Wecht, he was a coroner of Allegheny County at the time. He had him on the stand as his leading pathologist, the only pathologist he called to the stand in London on this particular point. And he said to Wecht, he says, now, Dr. Wecht, how would you categorize this bullet for the jury? And Wecht said, well, Mr. Spence, it was a magic bullet. He said, bullets don't even make right and left turns like this in cartoons. On cross-examination, I said, now, Dr. Wecht, I said, if this bullet was traveling from right to left on a downward trajectory, 2,000 feet a second, passes through soft tissue, you agree on all those things? He said, yes. I said, yet did not go on to hit Governor Connally, as you claim it did not. I said, why didn't that bullet, Dr. Wecht, tear up the interior of the limousine or hit the driver? He said, I don't know, Mr. Bugliosi. I didn't conduct the investigation in this case. And I said, well, you know, Dr. Wecht, I said, it seems to me that you have your own magic bullet here. I said, again, if the bullet passing right to left passes through soft tissue, once it exits the president's throat, if it did not go on to hit Connally and did not tear up the interior of the limousine or hit anyone else, I said, it must have zigzagged to the left. And he says, no, it need not have zigzagged to the left. I said, did it hop, skip, and jump over the car? He said, no, Mr. Bugliosi, it need not have performed any remarkable feats at all, feats like this at all. And I said, well, then, Dr. Wecht, tell this jury what happened to that bullet after it exited the president's throat. And he said, I don't know. Now, if you stop to think about it for a moment, Gary, once that bullet exited the front of the president's throat, if we're to believe the conspiracy theorists, it apparently vanished without a trace into thin air. And yet, the conspiracy theorists have wrapped this magic bullet appellation around the throat of the Warren Commission for many, many years, but it appears that it is they, not the Warren Commission, who had a magic bullet.
Well, what about the bullet itself? Now, a bullet that's gone through two people and torn up ribs,
right,
and so forth, and yet it's found on the stretcher in a pristine condition, not flattened or messed up.
Yeah. Okay, that's a lie that is told by the conspiracy theorists. They call it the pristine bullet. The bullet was rather pristine, but I guess if a bullet is pristine or anything's pristine, that means it's in its original condition. This bullet originally weighed 161 grains. It's now at the National Archives. It weighs 158.6 grains, so it lost 2.4 grains. What they do in their conspiracy books, Gary, they show the side of the bullet, and the side of the bullet looks like, you know, it's pristine. They don't show the base of the bullet. I show the base of the bullet in Reclaiming History, and it's badly damaged. So it's not a pristine bullet, but it's in pretty good shape. I will agree on that. Now, why is it in fairly good shape? Well, for one thing, that bullet was a fully metal jacketed bullet, a military type bullet, the type of bullet that was designed to cause a lot of damage without causing too much damage to itself. Also, it passed through soft tissue in Kennedy. And in Connally, it did hit some bones, but the first bone it hit was the fifth right rib, and it was a glancing blow. It wasn't a direct blow. It did strike a direct blow to the radius on his right arm, but the radius, I was told, is one of the softest bones in the body. But as I say, that bullet is a military-type bullet, and there's been testimony, not just from my expert in London, who was the coroner of Dallas County, but other experts, that the damage done to this bullet was not inconsistent with the damage that it caused to Connally and Kennedy.
Well, what about the mysterious deaths of people associated with the assassination investigation, including Dorothy Kilgallen, columnist?
All that. Mm-hmm. It's not true. It's not true. The House Select Committee found there was no, it was just pure nonsense. You know, it's a funny thing about these conspiracy theorists. They include under mysterious deaths the deaths of LBJ and J. Edgar Hoover, Oswald, Ruby. They're all mysterious deaths. That has been looked into in considerable depth, and they found no evidence connecting any one of these deaths with the assassination in any way whatsoever. But there was a London Sunday Times actuarial guy who came out with a statement in the first edition of the London Times, way back in, I think it was 1966, I think. saying that the likelihood of all these people being connected to the assassination and dying was like 1 out of 100 trillion or something like that. The second edition of the paper corrected itself, and they said this was based on really erroneous mathematical calculations. But the first edition had already gone out, and the conspiracy community, mostly in America, ran with it. But it's all nonsense. They haven't been able to show that any of these deaths were connected to the assassination.
Now, what about the photo of Oswald with his rifle? That's been claimed to be a fake. The shadow is wrong and so
forth.
Yeah.
Well, again, photographic experts of the House Select Committee said they debunked all of those arguments, said there was not a phony photograph at all. Marina, his wife, told me when I interviewed her down in Dallas that she took that photo. So that eliminates it right there. But apart from what Marina told me and also testified to, she testified to this in front of the House Select Committee that she took those photos, the whole photographic panel concluded that that was nonsense, that no one had tampered with that photo at all. In fact, a copy of the photograph was found in the possession of George de Morenschildt, a friend of Oswald, after he passed away, and it was autographed on the reverse side by Lee Harvey Oswald. So it's just all nonsense. They come up with these phony stories. At its core, this is a simple case. Within hours after the assassination, local law enforcement, Dallas Police Department, Sheriff's Office, local office of the FBI, they had concluded that Oswald killed Kennedy. And within about a day, it was obvious to them when they found out what an incredible kook that Oswald was, that he acted alone. So at its core, Gary, this is a very, very simple case. But there's another reality here. And that other reality, Gary, is that because of the unceasing and fanatical obsession of literally, and I'm not exaggerating here, literally thousands upon thousands throughout the years of assassination researchers and Warren Commission critics and conspiracy theorists who have examined every conceivable aspect of this case, put it under a high-powered microscope, split hairs, and then proceeded to split the split hairs, and made hundreds upon hundreds of allegations. This essentially simple case, Gary, has been transformed into its present state. The Kennedy case at the present time is now the most complex murder case, and I know quite a bit about murder cases, the most complex murder case in world history by far. Nothing even remotely comes close to this case in complexity. The Kennedy case is perhaps or certainly one of the most fascinating stories ever told. And that's why more words have been written about this case than any other single one-day event in world history, why people to this very day around the world talk about this case. The cast of characters alone rivals anything in Shakespeare. So it's just an incredible case.
And the book is called Reclaiming History, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, the author Vincent Bugliosi. Mr. Bugliosi, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. I know we've only just scratched the surface of this enormous book, but maybe you'll come back and when the book comes out in several volumes of paperback and talk again.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Gary. I want to thank you also for doing your homework and asking some very, very good questions. It was a pleasure being on the show.
Vincent Bugliosi and I did talk again a few more times, and he was always entertaining. He died on June 6th, 2015, at the age of 80. I hope you enjoyed listening to this conversation from 2007, and I hope you'll join us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.